Today on Maine Calling, the burning of Falmouth in 1775. 250 years ago, there was no city of Portland, Maine. In fact, Maine was not yet a state. Where Portland sits today was the town of Falmouth, Massachusetts, with about 2,500 residents, a busy and growing port town loyal to the Patriots during the Revolution. As such, it was the scene of a devastating British attack. On October 18, 1775, the British Navy bombarded Falmouth, then set fire to it, destroying almost everything. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we turn the clock back 250 years to that time period and learn about the impact and significance of the bombardment. And we'll hear about events happening this weekend on the anniversary of the devastating fire. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Leading up to the nation's 250th birthday next year, Maine is taking note of pivotal moments in history. One of these is the fire that decimated Portland, then Falmouth, in 1775. Today, we'll learn about what led up to what is known as the bombardment and the repercussions afterwards. My guest for the hour, Tiffany Link, who is Collections Curator at the Maine Historical Society, and Liam Rorden, Professor of History and Department Chair at the University of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Did you ever learn about the burning of Falmouth in 1775? What do you know about Maine 250 years ago? What are your questions? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Well, welcome to both of you. Tiffany, I'm going to start with you. Set us up. Take us to Falmouth, Massachusetts, which would later be Portland, Maine, in 1775. I understand about 2,500 people. How important was it as a port? How did people feel about the king? Let us know what life was like 250 years ago.
Yeah. So, 2,500 people is probably on the high end. You know, I think we don't have exact estimates. They say somewhere between maybe like 100 and 150 families. So it was a pretty small community. And at that time, we're still kind of on the Maine frontier. They'd only rebuilt Falmouth about 60 years before, after it had burned in 1690. The proprietors came back in and started rebuilding the town in the late 17-teens. So, you know, we're still kind of in a fresher, newer community that maybe doesn't have as deeply established roots as some other port towns in Massachusetts, like Boston or Salem or Marblehead. And so I like to say that survival here was just a little bit more tenuous. People were still kind of making their fortunes. And the merchant community was still very dependent on trade. And as a colonial entity, that really meant trade with the mother country, which was Britain. So options for trade were pretty limited. And as we're entering 1775, there have been several non-importation agreements, both enacted by the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, which is sort of the Patriot Congress established in opposition to the British government in Massachusetts. And then also later, the Continental Congress has established some non-importation or embargoes that really all of the colonies should be following.
So there was some tension there. The people who lived in Portland were dependent on the trading with England, but their own government, the Continental Congress and the government of Massachusetts, was saying, stop it.
To try to help force some action in Parliament. But, you know, merchant cities had a harder time agreeing with those non-importation agreements or abiding by them. And there was a lot of pressure from rural communities that were nearby, like Windham or Gorham or Scarborough, that weren't quite as dependent on trade for these more sort of elite, rich merchant cities to come under the Patriot control and to abide by these non-importation agreements.
So the people who really lived in the frontier, they were the people who were more patriotic at the moment.
At the moment, yes. Yeah, they certainly saw the people in Falmouth or, you know, Kittery, York, these other sort of coastal main cities that were dependent on trade as being kind of rich elites who kind of put profits ahead of liberties.
Okay, and I have to ask you just one question from what you just told me, that Portland had burned in 1690?
Yes.
Or Falmouth, yeah. I should say. I'm going to go back and forth the whole hour, I'm sure.
But and prior what happened to that, in 1676.
Really? I knew about the Great Fire in the 1860s, and I knew about this, but there had been two prior big fires?
Yes. Yeah, in King Philip's War, and then Liam, 1690, was King William, King Anne, another one of the colonial
wars. Oh, so neither one, both of these were attacks. They were not accidents.
Correct. Yes.
Okay, yes. Liam, your turn. We talked a little bit about this. I had just read a very well-regarded history of Falmouth in this time and learned that everybody in Portland, or most people in Portland, were real patriots. But what Tiffany's telling me makes me think that maybe that wasn't quite accurate.
Yeah, I think that a very difficult thing for us to remember looking back at the American Revolution is how difficult and uncertain and chaotic it was. So for instance, you just made the point that the Massachusetts government and the US government had declared these boycotts. But in fact, both the representative bodies that called for those boycotts were illegal according to the British Empire. So the provincial Congress is a sort of self-created entity. The Continental Congress, the same thing, has just been created in the fall of 1774. So all of this is new and uncertain, but what isn't uncertain is that we've had a decade of violence, that going back to 1765, there have been really angry, vocal street protests, particularly in Boston. And so the events that are going to lead to this great culmination on October 18th, 1775 for Falmouth comes at the end of a decade of growing violence. And Falmouth in many ways was caught in the middle of this, uncertain of where it wanted to take its stand.
Okay, so Falmouth wasn't necessarily targeted because they were patriots. It was a little more complicated than that. Why don't you set that up for us, Liam? We're about 6 months into the Revolutionary War, right? About 6 months since Lexington conquered. Already there's been the first naval battle of the war in Machias. Correct? I'm saying this slowly so you can correct me if I'm wrong. And now here we are in October of 1775. Why the heck did the British burn down Falmouth?
Well, I think I would start the local story in Falmouth in the spring of 1775. And it really comes back to the issue of how difficult these calls for an all-out boycott were. So Falmouth was an important port city. It had some major merchants there. It made it very different from any other town in Maine at this time. It was the only place that was really a significant transatlantic shipping town. And a Falmouth merchant got a new ship from Britain that was filled with supplies. And the question was, what should we do about this? Should we prohibit him taking the ship? Should it be sent back? He had begun this before a boycott had been announced, so should he be punished or not?
What was the name of the merchant? I'm just curious.
Henry Coulson was his name.
Okay, keep going.
So while that is being debated, a British naval vessel sails into Falmouth Harbor that was captained by Lieutenant Henry Mowat. So this is in early April 75. He is going to come back in October, but the first incident he has is he arrives in early April prior to Lexington and Concord. So he is still there, the debate is still going on, and then news of the fighting at Lexington and Concord arrives in Falmouth on April 20th. And now all of a sudden things are super pressure cooked. It's not just a question of this boycott, but oh my goodness, some kind of sustained warfare and violence has started in Massachusetts. The Falmouth Committee of Correspondence, so this would typically be Patriot leaders in Falmouth, are trying to get the rural militia not to come to Falmouth because they are just going to make this even more explosive. So they tell Colonel Samuel Thompson, another really important name, not to come. He says he won't come, but then he comes anyway, and he arrests or seizes Lieutenant Mowat, as well as some other individuals, including an Anglican minister of Falmouth, and he holds them prisoner. And so this is just a super tense situation. They hold him for about a week. They end up releasing him. And then Mowat helps to evacuate loyalists in Falmouth who were afraid for their safety because of raids from militia who are not from Falmouth coming into the city to enforce this new agenda of the Patriot movement.
Uh-huh. And so setting this up, Captain Mowat is already has a personal reason to dislike the Patriots in Portland. And it's not just going to be because of his orders later on. So pick up the story from there.
So that is true. But what I would also like to stress is that Falmouth leaders also were aghast at what had been done. And so I want to read you a quote from a letter of the Falmouth Committee of Correspondence describing these events of early spring 75. And they wrote to the Massachusetts Provincial Congress and they said, "We are afraid that if any number of men at any time and in any manner may collect together and attack anything or any person as they please, everybody may be in danger." So again, this is the sort of institutional representation of the Patriot movement in Falmouth saying, we are really worried about what these militia people are doing. They are going to get us in trouble and we are going to be punished.
And they were right.
And they were right.
Okay, so fast forward to October. Why the order from Admiral Graves, is that right? And why Falmouth, what will later be Portland, Maine?
Yeah. So basically Graves, who had been the commander of the Northern Squadron, had not used naval power to suppress the stirrings of this rebellion. But finally, he begins to change that and enact a stiffer policy. And partly he is doing this because of events in Machias, Maine. So in June of 1775, Machias has seized British vessels. They've killed a British naval officer in the fighting around that. And so Graves issues an order to Mowat's small flotilla of four ships and says, sail north from Boston and lay waste to nine cities. He names those cities, including Falmouth, and he ends that list saying, and especially punish Machias because they have done these terrible things.
But nine cities in the end, Tiffany, are not bombarded. Why not?
Yeah, so I think, Mowat's exact motivations probably aren't known, but he bypasses the nine cities or eight cities that were on the list, places like Salem or Marblehead, Falmouth, obviously. And it looks like he's probably headed straight for Machias, which makes sense because that was a pretty, they took the Margaretta at that time in June of 1775. And then shortly thereafter, they took two more British ships. They were using them to kind of patrol the coast up there and inhibit supply runs from Canada and other things. So that was a bit of an embarrassing debacle for them. And so I think, yes, heading to Machias for revenge was probably operation number one, but there was a storm around Booth Bay and they had to delay themselves for a little while. And they hadn't packed a terrible amount of supplies or additional clothing for the sailors on the ships. So they knew that they were going to head back to Boston rather than go all the way up the coast. And so they turn around. And, you know, what's right on their path back is Falmouth. And Falmouth is a very tempting target. You know, it's a pretty small city. It is entirely wooden at this point. There's really no stone or brick structures on the peninsula. Everything's very compact together on a gently sloping hillside. So there's not really tall structures impeding the structures kind of at the back of the city. It's a deep water port, as Liam noted, so you can really get right up to the coastline without getting trapped in a little harbor and have just sort of a blank canvas to fire your incendiary shot on and be very effective. And so I'm sure that Mowat's incident there in May also made it a tempting target, although after the Committee of Correspondence in Falmouth wrote to him and apologized, he said he forgave them and that he understood it was these outside actors that had sort of instigated that situation. One has to wonder if maybe he was still a little sore at the town for perhaps not doing more to protect him or to, keep the outside militia at bay.
And Tiffany, they knew people in Falmouth and in what's now Portland knew they were coming, right? They were able to flee.
So they, when they saw some British ships off the coast, they weren't sure who they were. They thought that it might be other British naval vessels, perhaps looking for livestock on the islands or something like that, because the British in Boston didn't have a lot of resources. And so they were kind of going out to these islands up and down the coast to get lumber or livestock to feed their soldiers. And so in the beginning, they were a little suspicious, and some representatives went out to check out who these ships were. And when they discovered it was Mowat, they were actually relieved because of this exchange that they had had where he had forgiven the town and acknowledged that they were not bad actors. But then he informed them that he was there to bombard the town and that they had a very short amount of time to prepare. There were negotiations with town leaders where they said, give us until tomorrow morning. We'll turn over our militia stores, all of our weapons, and show that we aren't standing against the king in that manner. And he said, I'll give you until the morning. That's great. But between that chat and the next day, which was the 18th, there was obviously a lot of chaos in town. People were concerned anyway after they heard the news. They were starting to pack up their belongings and make plans to leave for other locations. And then, of course, outside militia again show up in Falmouth from some of the more rural communities. And all of this sort of prevents the weapons exchange or further communication with Mowat. And I think he gives them like an extra 45 minutes beyond the deadline he had set, but he does start bombarding the town around 10 o'clock in the morning, and it goes on for about 6 hours. And then he sends in Marines to burn additional buildings that the incendiary shot hadn't taken care of to his satisfaction.
Liam,
9 hours in total.
9 hours in total, 6 hours of bombardment, and then people going on land and setting fire to anything that wasn't already destroyed. And Liam, when we think about Portland today, we're thinking about what would be called today maybe the Old Port area, the base of Montjoy Hill, correct? Not the Stroudwater area, which is another settlement. We're talking about, but Liam, that part of Portland, and we do need to go to break soon, but that part of Portland was destroyed, correct?
Yeah, the devastation was substantial. So between 2/3 and 3/4 of this small town that was really nestled on the water was destroyed by the bombardment and the fire and also later militia raids upon the town of Falmouth.
All right. Well, so much more to talk about. We need to talk about whether or not the bombardment had the effect that the British wanted it to have. We need to talk about how quickly Falmouth rebuilt, but we do need to go to a break. If you have questions for our history experts, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're learning about the British attack on Maine in 1775, or what would later become Maine. What brought on the burning of Falmouth, and what do we know about that fire and its aftermath? Joining me today, Liam Riordan, a chair and professor of history at the University of Maine, and Tiffany Link, collections curator with the Maine Historical Society. We invite you to join the conversation. What are your questions about this period in Maine history? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we return to the story itself, we're going to take a little time to talk about some of the events this weekend to mark this day, October 18th. Joining us now, Dr. Amy Keithan, who is Educational Programs Manager for Greater Portland Landmarks. Thanks so much for calling in, Amy.
For having me.
I understand there is a history trail this Saturday, America from the Ashes. Tell us what's in store for that day.
We have a great program lined up. We have seven history and cultural organizations that have gotten together, and everyone is going to be doing a different activity during the day. First Parish Church, Greater Portland Landmarks, Maine Historical Society, Maine Ulster Scots Project, Osher Map Library, Spirits Alive at Eastern Cemetery, and the Tate House Museum. Everyone is going to be having a different activity you can look at on the Maine Historical website. Greater Portland Landmarks has come up with a puzzle walk through Portland. As we just heard, there's not very many places left that actually have any sort of evidence of this sort of tragic event that really wiped out most of the city. So our challenge has been, how do we bring back that sense of place? And we're going to be doing that by providing a guide for people that they can pick up on Saturday morning at Maine Historical Society. And they'll be brought to different parts of the city and given information on the guide about what it was like there in the 1770s. Pick up some clues along the way, and then at the end there is a very special opportunity for them to really sort of come to grips with the entire event and how it affected the city.
Amy, people think of Greater Portland Landmarks as a place that preserves landmarks. As you mentioned, there are none left from this time or from this burning. So how does this fit in with your mission there?
We are really expanding our concept of historic preservation because we realize that heritage is not just about buildings. It's about a sense of space, really, and a sense of place, what makes someplace special. So we're really trying to move into the communities and actually figure out how can historic senses of place, historic buildings, historic parks, communities, how can we use those to address contemporary issues like affordability and climate change? And in doing that, we really have to ask, what happened there before? We're looking at things like place names and how did communities grow up from the history that happened in those places. So we're actually looking at ourselves as an organization that can help the public do those things, to see differently, to see into the past differently. And that was certainly a challenge with this particular project.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for calling in. And it's a perfect segue because we do need to talk about how the community recovered. Amy Keithan with Greater Portland Landmarks. I'm going to get back to the story. We're at October 18th, 1775. Falmouth, Massachusetts, what would later become Portland, Maine, has been bombarded by the British. But Tiffany, we haven't talked about what was the strategic reason for the British to do this. Did they just want to punish the Patriots, or did they think, well, if we destroy the city, we're going to bomb them into submission and they're going to change their mind?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. You know, I think that especially under Thomas Gage, who had been the colonial governor of Massachusetts, who had been dealing with most of this, you know, in the 1770s as things were escalating, had been hesitant to be too forceful in some circumstances. He'd lived in the colonies for a really long time. And I think he, you know, didn't want to come down too heavy-handed. These were still British subjects, and, you know, for a government to make the decision to take action against their own citizens is a pretty major thing. So I think that there had been some hesitancy leading up to the 1775 to be too forceful. But, you know, we'd hit a point with Concord and Lexington. Though the British had won the Battle of Bunker Hill, it didn't really go terribly well for them. There'd been the incidents in Machias, and there was still this prolonged stalemate happening around Boston. And I think something needed to happen, in their opinion, that would swing the pendulum more in their favor, and kind of taking out some of these coastal port cities, some of whom were far more patriot-leaning, you know, the ones closer to Boston, and maybe were helping to fund some of this, you know, were enclaves of some of the more patriot leaders and militia that were in the area, that it might just sort of help break up this rebellion.
Mm-hmm. It didn't work out that way, did it, Liam?
No.
It didn't work out to help break up the rebellion, did it?
Yeah, I'll just underscore what Tiffany said. The British at this point felt they had been too lenient, and they had just tolerated rejection of their laws for a decade and terrible violence. And in particular, they saw New England as the rotten apples in the colonies, that these were the extremists. And if they could punish New England, it would help bring the rest of the colonies to their senses. They would have an isolated conflict just with Boston and Massachusetts, really. But of course, that use of state power led to violence that then launches a much larger event.
How quickly, Tiffany, does Portland rebuild?
It takes a while. Liam may be able to speak to this a little better than I can, but there isn't sort of major resettlement until after the war. You know, like that's when you see sort of like the Longfellows coming back to town and some other things. So it takes quite a while. There are a few structures left. You know, Greeley's Tavern still stands. Another tavern called Marston's is still there. The First Parish Church, not quite as you see it now, but doesn't burn. So there's still some town business and people living on the outskirts, but the peninsula itself, it takes quite a while.
Liam, so the war, when it does start to rebuild, though, it does start to rebuild pretty quickly, right?
Well, I think yes and no. You know, the war itself will run until 1783, and then there's a terrible economic depression in the 1780s and into the 90s. So it will take quite a while before the city rebuilds. And I do want to go back to the destruction of the city just for a moment, because so there's the naval bombardment, and then the British do land a party of about 30 Marines who do set fire to a number of buildings. But then they withdraw, and the city of Falmouth is then plundered by militia from the interior. And I think this is really a crucial thing to keep in mind, right? We often want to think about the American Revolution as a good versus evil struggle. Right. I mean, that's why we love Star Wars. That's why we love Indiana Jones. We know who to root for and who to dislike. But the actual destruction of the city was carried out in part by militia from towns outside of Falmouth itself. And there's some incredible testimony about this from the Gorham Town Meeting. They censure their own citizens for having plundered the town of Falmouth. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress will issue a declaration demanding that people return the property they stole from Falmouth. So the destruction definitely happened, but how to explain it and understand it is a little bit more complicated than just blaming that British fleet.
Yeah. And we're actually have a notice in our collection that is for the return of the looted goods. So it's a more recent acquisition that we'll be excited to show in our exhibit next year.
And it's so exciting, Tiffany. I've been on Main Memory Net and seen there are a lot of documents from this period. You all are not guessing at how people felt or what happened. It's really well documented. Fascinating. We're going to go to Stuart, who's calling from Vassalboro. Hi, Stuart. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I'm a member of the Vassalboro Historical Society, and I did want to give a plug for our museum right here in East Vassalboro. We have a wonderful collection of Indian artifacts and other things. If you're on Route 32 in East Vassalboro, please stop in. And this is my question. The town of New Portland in western Maine, near Kingfield, I had heard that that was resettled by some of the residents of Portland who had suffered the fire. Do you know anything about that?
I do know that a lot came from the Portland area and sort of around this time. You know, I don't know exclusively those who were fleeing the fire, refugees. A lot of people in Portland also had property elsewhere, like in Windham or Gorham. They had larger farms in those areas, even if they were sort of Portland town merchants. But there were also a lot of refugees who didn't have a set place to go. And I know that some of them went to the New Portland area.
Stuart, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go now to Holly Hurd. Holly's calling in. She's the executive director at the Tate House Museum in Portland. Thanks so much for calling in, Holly.
Thank you for asking me.
So the Tate House is one of the few.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the Tate House in that little settlement in Stroudwater, kind of near the airport today, is an area that was spared. Do we know why?
Yes, the reason is that Mowat couldn't get his large-ish type ships up there because that's tidal, and so that area was safe. And it's the reason that the Tate House Museum, which was built in 1755, survives today. And it's actually related to some of the programs that we are doing. So we are the only colonial area museum in all of Cumberland County, and so we interpret that time period. And we're really excited about something that's happening at our museum on October 18th, which is that we actually have simulations of the view from the Tate House. It's a fairly big house, and the third floor, there's a straight shot view to Portland Harbor. And we've actually created, with the help of a company known as a Viewshed, so that people can actually view what the Tate family would have seen from the safety of their home. So we're really excited to unveil that on Saturday.
So people can climb up to the third floor, pretend to look out the window, and see what the family saw.
Actually, for the most part, our programs are going to be in what's called the wing of the house, because the getting up the stairs is fairly treacherous. But we have the simulated views from there. If you go up to the third floor now, all you'll see is the next door building and lots of trees in the way. So this company has actually done the simulations where they've removed the buildings and the trees. And the thing that the docents at our museum talk about is that George Tate, who would have been a MAST agent at the time or some decades earlier than that, is that he could have seen when MAST ships came in to the Portland Harbor. And, you know, that's an amazing thing because it's close to 4 miles away. But they've got a straight view from that house, which, you know, from the third floor is about 35 feet tall. So, it's going to be really interesting. One of the things that we're going to talk about is that they were members of St. Paul's Church, which was one that was right in the heart of the area that was burned. And they could have, in fact, seen that. That's a big reveal there. So we are going to be interpreting the what happened on that day with period dressers, George Tate and other members of the family that research has shown would have likely been there at the Tate House. And, you know, them watching that happen, we actually have a record from Mowat that says that the church started burning at 1:30 p.m. So we know those details. And like I said, we plan to do sort of a dramatic retelling of that story with period dressed characters.
Holly, I have a couple quick questions for you. And I know Liam wants to ask you a question. You mentioned that George Tate was a MAST agent, and this meant that he secured what people know of as King Pines for British ships. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then also, he was a patriot, right? But his sons were not.
No, he was not a patriot.
He was a loyalist, but then his sons were not. Thanks for correcting me. But his sons, not necessarily.
Yes. Well, actually, that whole loyalist-patriot story is very interesting. And just in the last couple of weeks, we actually have new research that has shown that the son, whose name is William Tate, actually was a very strong loyalist. And we've done a lot that has actually interpreted this. No one knew. Everything that's in published records right now is that William and, okay, so George Tate, and he had four sons. So the story that we've told is that people have sort of assumed that they had loyalist leanings because he was involved in working sort of indirectly with the Crown through the Royal Navy. And so what happened with them? Well, interestingly, most of the records about the Tate family are just non-existent. So we're like, what were they up to? People sort of assumed that. But we have new information that, in fact, William Tate had a house that was what I call front row during the bombing. It was would have been on roughly 4th Street. And so we actually, what the story we're going to tell is that we believe that William actually went aboard Mowat's ship. Although that's not recorded, that story makes a lot of sense based on a deposition that he did some years later, because he actually fled to England. And we didn't know this until about 2 weeks ago.
Really? So, how did you find this William, deposition?
Well, there's some new records that are just, I think, new online that are from the UK. And so all of that is described in great detail and all of the possessions that he had and what was burned. And so anyway, we're very excited to tell that story with William as loyalist, who, in fact, did flee during that time. We've been doing a lot of research. I was listening to what Tiffany and Liam were saying that, you know, it's pretty well known based on that information who were the loyalists. And I've counted up there were about 22 of them. And so, as they've mentioned, they were the prominent wealthy merchants in town primarily. But there were, I mean, not only there were about 2,000 people living in the town at the time. So if you allow for, you know, numbers of families, I mean, to me, that looks like the strong loyalists were only about 5% of the town. So, again, this is brand new. And so we can all discuss all of this. But I think, as people have said, we've got your strong loyalists, you know, who were sort of in the minority. You've got your strong patriots who may have been the minority. Most people were somewhere in between. And that's the story that we've told about the Tate family, that they were sort of laying low, maybe just trying to wait to see what happened, what was going to happen during the war. But we now know that William Tate's son was gone. He took off and went to Bristol and later London and did not return until 1784, after the war was over.
Wow. Liam, you had a question for Holly.
Well, I really wanted to draw her out about the allegiance of the Tate family, which she did nicely. And I think it kind of returns to that point I was making earlier about just how complicated and difficult circumstances were in the spring and fall of 1775, and really for the next couple of years. It was extremely difficult to navigate this and figure out what was the best course for you and your family. It was not an easy or automatic choice, except for a handful of extremists on either side.
What's so interesting to me, Tiffany, I had just mentioned that you all have so many documents, you know so much, and here Holly has found something just 2 weeks ago that changes the narrative. Is this happening all the time?
Yeah, I think as more things show up online from repositories that are far flung, you know, obviously sort of half of the documents associated with the revolution will be found in Britain. And so the more that they put online or publish, or a lot of things about the revolution have been published, but that doesn't always make them easily accessible. So, you know, the more that you can search easily and the more that you can reach in terms of geography and collections will continue to bring more things to light. And I think it just shows that although this story is 250 years old, you can always find something new.
Well, I need to ask you, Holly, given that, are there other questions you want to answer? Are there big questions that you're hoping to find documents to answer? And if so, what are those?
Wow. Always. That's always true. I mean, you're talking about related to this particularly.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I dug in deeply to the, exactly what Mowat was up to, as they already described. You know, he was there sort of 6 months earlier. And I found it curious that, I mean, he was in the harbor, I'm not sure if they mentioned this, during the Lexington alarm. So he had come to relieve Coulson, who was having trouble with people saying, you can't, you know, we're not going to let you bring supplies on board. So he stayed there. He was called. He was down in Boston. He was called. Actually, he was on his way up to Halifax and to repair his ship. And they called, you know, Admiral Graves said, you know, you need to go and help our mast ship captain who's building a, you know, a ship for the, you know, the Navy. So come back and help him. So he was there, you know, so you can imagine that would have caused a little bit. There was lots of tension. I described that situation as sort of like our version of the Boston Massacre, where we've got pushing and shoving and people, you know, lining up. And, you know, it was not a pretty thing. I mean, at one point, I don't know if they already said this, but at one point, somebody shoots at the Canso, which is Kenry Mowat's vessel. And this makes him really mad. And he threatens at that time to bomb the town. You know, there had been a couple of threats during that time that we're going to take you out. So, you know, in that sense, he did end up doing what he said. It was just, you know, 6 months later.
Mm-hmm. And Holly, as we've mentioned on the program, we're doing a story about how the city was, or the town at the time, was destroyed. But if somebody goes to the Stroudwater area and looks at the Tate House and some of the other older homes clustered there, can we get a sense of what perhaps the rest of Portland looked like in 250 years ago?
Well, a sense as far as the form of the houses, but of course it would have looked very different as a port. It was not a port area particularly. I mean, they did do shipbuilding and things like that a little bit later, but, you know, it would have looked quite different with the wharves. And so there's a deep channel that goes very close, you know, to Portland Harbor, which, as they mentioned, you know, it sort of made Portland a sitting duck, more or less, for bombardment from the British Navy. But they can't get upstream, so it's protected. And so, yes, certainly the house forms, and there are a number of them. It is a historic district, the Stroudwater Historic District. And so that is a wonderful place to visit in that sense, for sure.
All right. Well, Holly Hurd, thank you so much for calling in. Holly Hurd is with the Tate House Museum. We are going to take a break. We have some time for your questions for our historians today. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send an email, talk@mainpublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The year 1775, a pivotal time for Maine and the nation. We're learning about the context that led to the burning of Falmouth, also known as the bombardment that burned what is now Portland to ashes. With me, Tiffany Link with the Maine Historical Society and Liam Reardon with the UMaine History Department. Share your comments and questions or give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here from Bruce. Was Falmouth also burned in 1722 to 1725 like many other settlements? You all had mentioned 1690. No, Tiffany?
No.
Okay. So spared that round of fires, I guess.
Yeah.
I do want to ask Tiffany, we keep saying Falmouth, which is later Portland. When does it become Portland? Tell us when we're no longer on Falmouth Neck, but instead in Portland, Maine?
I believe 1796, 86. Liam, do you?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But pretty soon afterwards.
Yeah, shortly after the war. Mm-hmm. 86 maybe is the correct date. But
all right. Well, you know,
shameful. I should know.
Well, it's what was I going to say? It's so fun to hear the story, right? The story of the distance past. But I'm wondering, Liam, what we learned from it today? Why commemorate it? What do you think we ought to be thinking about in 2025 when we're thinking about the American Revolution and specifically what the role of this place where we live was in it?
Thanks for that question, Jennifer. I think that what is really exciting to me about history is that it does change. And that might not seem to make common sense. We had the example that Holly just shared about finding new evidence, and all of a sudden we have a different sort of understanding. And that happens sometimes, although it's relatively rare, particularly for an older era of history like this. But our sense of the past also changes because of the questions that we want answered in the present. And so when we look at this event on October 18th, 1775, we see a terrible exertion of state power that causes senseless violence and that leads to yet more senseless violence. This helps hurl us into a revolutionary war. When that event celebrated its bicentennial in 1975, It was in the midst of U.S. failure in Vietnam. And historians who wrote about the event then took as a lesson that that exertion of state power backfires, that you can't really use coercion to get what you want. It just leads to an escalation of violence. And then in the news break that we just listened to, we heard the governor of Illinois worried about the application of state power in Chicago that has led to more violence. So this really is a living question for us. What is the appropriate use of state power? And can the violence of the state be mobilized effectively against its own civilians, or is that a huge blunder?
And is it ironic or is it not? And Tiffany, I'll turn to you, that the same day you and other organizations are planning these wonderful commemorative events about what happened 250 years ago in what's now Portland, Maine, is the same time that people will be taking to the streets in Portland and holding up signs that say "No Kings."
Yeah, I mean, I think that now is a particularly interesting time to be studying the American Revolution and going through these anniversary dates, you know, the ones that have already passed this year, the ones that are coming up, and to really look at our past and our founding and what people found concerning at the time, you know, concerning enough to protest in the streets or to defy a British warship, and what that means for today. And I'll just go off of what Liam said as well, is that it does backfire usually when you use coercive acts like this. I mean, it had already backfired for the British in 1774 when they enacted the coercive acts on Boston and they shut down the port and let soldiers, you know, quarter in people's homes. There were issues with arresting people without warrants, you know, and that had created quite a reaction across the colonies. And so that hadn't worked. The burning of Falmouth didn't work. It even shocked people in Britain. They thought it was a lie. They had such a hard time believing that their own government would fire upon its citizens that they assumed it was just patriot propaganda. And then when they found out it was true, they kind of tried to console themselves by saying, well, there must be part of the story we aren't hearing. There must be something more that Falmouth did to really warrant this action. Because it was a really hard thing for them to grasp. And so I think we shouldn't lose sight of that we were British subjects at the time, that the colonies were British subjects at the time, and that they should have been afforded the same sort of state protections from their government, and theoretically been able to come to or negotiate nonviolent, you know, solutions to their issues. But it had come to this. And so I think there is something that we can learn from that, both in terms of taking a step back, but then also looking at what the concerns were 250 years ago and how those might mirror some of the concerns today.
Mm-hmm. So it shocked people in England. Oh, go ahead, Liam.
For me, the big past-present connection here is that we know that today we are a badly polarized United States. And I think what we forget is that during the revolutionary era, we were an even more divided revolutionary society. So there is a lot to gain by thinking about the events of 250 years ago in the context of our current moment.
And just a note, our producer, Cindy Hahn, quickly researched it is 1786 that Portland was incorporated as Portland, chosen to honor the Isle of Dorsetshire, England, which is kind of interesting, even after the revolution, naming the town for something that was British. Before we go, the Isle of Portland in Dorsetshire, England, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. I apologize to all you Anglophiles. Liam, before we go, you have a new book out, Essays. Tell me about it.
Well, this is a collection of essays that came out of the commemoration of Maine statehood in 2020. So it is, some of the essays look at the statehood era, others look at the state centennial in 1920, and others looked at museum exhibits in 2020 that were commemorating the statehood process. So just like we're commemorating the start of the American Revolution with this event today, this is another sort of commemorative project that was more about state history. And the connection there is the importance of public history, of trying to communicate something about our shared past with a broad general audience, and ideally to get public input and contributions about what is important to remember in our past.
And before we go, Tiffany, we have about 30 seconds left. Holly Hurd told us about this document she just found that changed everything. What is your big question? What are you hoping to find a document to answer someday soon?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. But, I think it would be great if we knew what Mowat's real intention was. Like, was he really still wanting revenge against Falmouth? Was it just the thing that was easiest on his path back to Boston where he knew he could really make an impact? Or was it just luck?
Well, thank you both so much. Such an interesting program. That was Tiffany Link, Collections Curator with the Maine Historical Society, and Liam Reardon, who is Chair and Professor of History at UMaine. Our sound engineer today, Jane Donahue, Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look at the expanding role of pharmacists. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.